Medical Matters on Talk About. Brought to you in association with the Bon Secours Hospital, Tralee. Celebrating 100 years of advanced medicine and exceptional care.
Well, let's stay on topic for a moment because Eamon is with us. Eamon, am I right in saying that there's some kind of a condition that people suffer from that makes them sweat more than others? Is that right?
Oh, yeah. That is very true. It's a condition called hyperhidrosis, and it's a horrible condition. On the coldest day, people, if they spread out their fingers, you can see the sweat dripping off the tips of their fingers. There is a thing in our bodies called the autonomic nervous system that controls a whole variety of things, including sweating. And for some people, their autonomic nervous system never switches that off. Curiously, one of the treatments that can be used for that is to effectively paralyze that system by injecting Botox into relevant parts of the body, and you can control the sweating that way. But before you get to that, there's various kinds of very powerful antiperspirants that can be used as well. But it's a horrible condition for people to have.
Yeah, absolutely. But relatively rare, is it?
Yes, uncommon. I'm trying to think, in the last 35 years, maybe two or three people I've seen over that time. It's well known about, and I know I've spoken about it on the radio previously, but it's not something that fortunately we see that very often.
Okay, very good. Well, listen, Eamon, we're going to start this week by chatting about a very interesting letter I got in from a listener, a handwritten letter, on the subject of Ozempic. Am I saying it right? The injection you get Ozempic. You might just bear with me for a second. I'll read it to you because I think this gentleman's observations are interesting. He says, I'm 67-year-old male with type 2 diabetes and also obesity. I've been on the Ozempic injection for some time, a dose of 1.00 milligrams. It has been more than difficult. My symptoms have included reflux, nausea, vomiting and diarrhea. I'm also getting a foul taste in my mouth. My appetite has been suppressed most definitely, and I've lost 5 or 6 pounds. The thought of food sickens me, and I have decided, but I've decided to forego this injection completely. There are safer ways of dealing with diabetes and obesity. Why would anyone even consider this injection when the side effects are known well in advance? I have found the answer to be from doing what is natural, i.e. reducing my portions of food and as much exercise as possible. I wonder what do listeners think of this Ozempic? So that came in from a listener. Eamon, you might talk to us a little bit about this injection. It does seem like there's some pretty horrible side effects.
There is, yeah. I suppose the thing about it is that it's one of a group of medications that have been on the go for perhaps the last 10 or 12 years that involve chemicals that are involved in the absorption of food from the gut. So the generic name for Ozempic is semaglutide. The class of medications it's from is the GLP-1s. I can't remember what the GLP-1 stands for. It's in injection form. There is a related drug that's in tablet form. And bottom line is they make people feel nauseated, and hence the reason why they don't want to eat. This is a hugely difficult area, and one in which I need to be extremely careful. Diabetes is a large and increasingly large problem, and we're seeing more and more people with diabetes. Equally, and in parallel with that, we're seeing a lot of people with more and more overweight, and indeed more and more people are into the category of obese, and the two are absolutely definitely related. For many people, it is being overweight is what is the cause of their diabetes. And conversely, and here is the crux of the matter, if you can reduce the person's weight, then you can, in many cases, either normalize the blood sugars or, the politically correct phrase is you can put the diabetes into remission. I take it further. For people who can lose enough weight, and that's the big if, then people can be cured of their diabetes for all intents and purposes. The big if is if they can lose weight, and that's the challenge that we face. And there's something interestingly we've been debating, and I think we actually need to reframe this in an entirely different way. One, it is fair to argue that we're in, and I'll use a piece of jargon, an obesogenic environment. And that is that We are surrounded and bombarded by media of various forms, which encourage us to take a variety of things. And of course, they'll always put in the caveat and say, if taken in appropriate portion size. But the reality is all of us, myself included, are not great for looking after portion size. So the problem is that people eat too much. And I think rather than focusing on individuals who have issues, either with diabetes or obesity, I think we need to look at the environment around us and see what can be done at a societal level, at a national level, and indeed at an international level, to try to reduce the environment that brings about the situation where people eat too much.
Yeah, this is it. And of course, all this, you know, supersizing and all you can eat and all these offers of, you know, two pizzas for the price of one, that's not helping.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. You're absolutely right, Deirdre. So I think that rather than focusing in on individual solutions or not solutions, as the case may be, like semaglutide and dulaglutide and other medications like that, not to mention things like bariatric surgery, bypass surgery and all the rest of it, I think we need to look at it in the environment in which people have to live and see what can be done to try to reduce the pressure on people to eat more.
This is it. Well, that's a topic in itself for another day, I would imagine. Eamon, we'll move on. We have a Dingle listener. She says, is it normal to be tired after a hip replacement in mid-February? I have had fibromyalgia for many years and find it hasn't calmed down since my hip operation. I'm a lady in my late 60s.
First and foremost, the fibromyalgia and the hip operation are two completely unrelated conditions, and having the hip operation in and of itself will not have any impact whatsoever on your fibromyalgia, unfortunately. The purpose of the exercise, if you remember, we had the lovely Mr. Gardisi on with us a couple of weeks ago, and Mr. Gardisi was making the point, hip replacements are for pain, and it's specifically to relieve the pain of an arthritic joint. As he made the point as well too, the artificial hip will never return the same degree of mobility or flexibility that the person had, that they would get from the natural hip joint, but it's all about taking away the pain. I think the thing is that where people have had an anaesthetic, they can be knocked out for quite some time afterwards. However, this is the month of June, we're talking about 4 months afterwards. I would expect that within the next month or two, they should be getting back to their more usual energy, and if they're not, they probably need to talk to their GP and chase it up further.
Okay, Anne in Tralee has back pain and pain in her lower hips, but she only has it when she's... she doesn't have it when she's sitting or lying down. So back pain and pain in her lower hips when she's standing or walking, presumably.
Yeah, there's a couple of possibilities there. By far and away, the most common problem is that as we get older, and if you take an MRI of everybody in their 50s, 60s, 70s and so on, or even their 40s, you'll find lots of wear and tear in the spine, and where that is putting pressure on nerves and things, and indeed muscles that can cause discomfort and soreness. The kind of scenario we'll be watching out for, and the one I'd be careful of, is the situation where the person finds that it's the length, the distance they walk, that is related to their pain, because there are a number of conditions where circulation is affected, and the more the person walks, the more painful they get. On the other hand, if that's not the case, if you're just uncomfortable when you're up and around, it's probably just the usual wear and tear of the back. I would always recommend in the first instance talk to your physio about that, or get an appointment through your GP for a physiotherapist.
Okay. This sounds like a fairly straightforward question, Eamon. A texter wants to ask you, does a person need to fast for having their bloods done, especially cholesterol? A nurse told me that you don't need to fast.
Yeah, the answer is actually no. I mean, I know it's been traditional for people to ask to be fasted. I think the trick is not to have a very fatty meal just before you have your blood test done. The thing is total cholesterol level really isn't affected by whether you've been eating or not, but the other bits of it, what they call the LDL and the HDL, can be affected by if you've had a recent very fatty meal. It's probably a good idea to at least abstain, and it is probably fair to say you don't have to fast, but it's still the habit that people are saying, yes, fast for the cholesterol estimation. Other blood tests, it makes no difference whatsoever.
Okay, fair enough. Eamon, we'll take a quick break at this stage. We've more questions for you, but we would welcome a few more if anyone wants to get in touch with us. Text or WhatsApp the usual number 083 300 3300. 17 minutes
there. Medical Matters on Talk About. Brought to you in association with the Bonsecour Hospital Tralee. Celebrating 100 years of advanced medicine and exceptional care.
Now we're with Dr. Eamon Shanahan for this week's Medical Matters. We're taking your general queries. You can phone Brenda if you've anything on your mind that you'd like advice on, 066 712 3666. Next up, Eamon, an elderly caller, I presume a male caller, who wants to know how dangerous is a growth in the prostate?
Really interesting question, and the reason I'm saying that is that studies done in Scandinavia have shown that a significant percentage of older men, and talk about men, probably 10 to 20% of older men, will, if you do post-mortem examinations, will find that they did have prostate cancer at the time of their death, but it was absolutely categorically not the prostate cancer that caused their death. They died of old age. The situation is that there is a percentage of cancers, of prostate cancers, that can be quite aggressive, but the majority of prostate cancers are actually not aggressive. And therefore, there has been a swing back to the watchful waiting, waiting and watching and see how the man gets on. The difficulty is that the diagnostic procedures involved, even though they're becoming less invasive, still of themselves have the risk and the potential to cause quite serious ill health to the individual, to the man. So there is a balance that's being struck between investigating appropriately and following the man up, and on the other hand, where it is clear that the prostate cancer is not going to do the man any harm, leave well alone. I'm not saying that we shouldn't be ignoring prostate cancer. We should still be taking note of prostate cancer, and it still is a significant cause of death in men. But the majority of men who have prostate cancer will die of old age, not die from the prostate cancer.
Okay, and when that person says a growth on the prostate, is there such a thing as a benign growth on a prostate?
It's not so much a growth, but rather the prostate gland in all men, as they get older, the prostate gland gets bigger. It's just part and parcel of the aging process. And we call that benign prostatic hypertrophy. Hypertrophy is a medical term for just an enlargement. So it's a benign enlargement of the prostate gland. It's not a growth. It's just the normal, natural process. All men, if they live long enough, will have large prostate glands.
Okay, no, it's just when they said there was a growth that I was just wondering where they were coming from.
Say the only growth I'd say they're talking about is the prostate cancer.
Now, a Listole caller is going for a bunion operation. She wants to know if this is serious and how long is the recovery time?
Okay, the quick answer is you need to talk to your surgeon about that. I think the thing is that there's no such thing as a trivial operation, but there are bigger operations, there are smaller operations. In that, it depends, again, you see, on what is going to be done to straighten out the toe. I would believe that bunion operations are on the less severe end of the spectrum. But the recovery period afterwards, I genuinely don't know. Probably weeks. I doubt if it's days. That's a question that your own surgeon will definitely answer for you before he or she operates.
Yeah, I know somebody who had bunion operation, and she was definitely on crutches for a month, I would imagine. Every person is different, Eamon, in that case. Yeah. We'll move on with a 36-year-old mom. And in the last few months, she says she's finding she's sweating very much under her arms, particularly under one arm, and has wet patches under her arms constantly. She's wondering, is there anything she can do with this?
Again, the fact that it's affecting one side more than the other, I'd just be a bit wary about that, and especially that it's new onset. If it's something you've had all your life, that's a different kettle of fish, but if there's something that's only started in the last couple of months, I would suggest that they maybe need to talk to their own GP, and in due course of time, maybe sit down and have a chat with them, and they'll organise the appropriate investigations just to make sure there's nothing else going on.
A listener says, I have a prolapsed urethra. I'm in my 70s. What can be done for this female caller?
Yeah. One of the quick answers is that one of the things that you see very frequently in postmenopausal women is that there is a lack of oestrogen around the vulva, the vagina and so on, and that local oestrogen therapy, not hormone replacement therapy, which is a different subject, but local oestrogen therapy can be effective at relieving some of these things. It depends on the degree of disability that the woman is experiencing. It may be that local oestrogen therapy plus physiotherapy might be of benefit, but I suspect that if it's particularly troublesome, it may require surgery. But this is something you'll have to talk to a gynecologist about.
Now, this is unusual. John was in touch, and he's wondering if you have heard of, wait for it, gaze evoked tinnitus, and if you have heard of it, what is the treatment for it? That's G-A...
Okay, not tinnitus.
Yeah, G-A-Z-E dash evoked tinnitus.
No, I haven't come across that one before. I mean, I know tinnitus well. The implication is that if somebody's gazing or if somebody moves their eyes in a certain way, that triggers the tinnitus. No, I would have to look it up myself.
Okay. Listener says, I had an ultrasound recently and was told I have a fatty liver. What are the repercussions of this? How can I rectify it? And this is a lady in her 60s.
Yeah. Okay, so again, we would have had one of the colleagues from the Bonds on about talking just recently about this. Fatty liver is a state where literally there's fat in the liver. That's literally what it boils down to. It's a metabolic condition. In many cases, it's related to diet and weight, and it reflects back to what we were talking about earlier on in terms of the obesogenic environment that we live in. Fatty liver occasionally leads on to a thing called hepatosteatosis, and exceptionally rarely may lead to cirrhosis of the liver and liver problems as a consequence. In the vast majority of cases, changes in lifestyle can be very beneficial. In other words, losing weight and avoiding fats in the diet can help to reverse the problem.
A listener says her 10-year-old daughter has a very sore ingrown toenail. It's her big toe. It's starting to bleed every day now. We've bathed it with salt and water and put pseudocreme on it, but is there anything else we can do?
Okay, stop using the pseudo, please. Stop using the pseudocreme. I'm a great fan of the pseudocreme, but pseudocreme should never be used in this situation. The problem is the pseudocreme is an emulsion of petroleum jelly, Vaseline and talcum powder. And so talcum powder gets into the wound and it's actually making the problem worse. So please, please, please stop using the pseudocreme. Bathe by all means. The only way that you're going to get this sorted is to try and get either the one half of the toenail or the whole toenail removed. Talk to your own GP. The problem is waiting lists for this procedure are quite long, publicly and privately. But the thing to do is you need to have the toenail partially or completely removed. That's the only way you're going to sort this problem out.
Yeah, is it unusual in a child, an ingrown toenail?
No, it's very common. Very common.
Is it?
Very common in children. Yeah, Jesus, I remember I had my ingrown toenail was done, I think, 3 times when I was between 10 and 20 years of age.
Caller has been advised to reduce sugar in his diet. How can this be achieved? Does he have to cut out sugar in his tea or is there something he can take?
Yeah, you could use sweeteners if you wanted. You could use sweeteners if you wanted. Again, and this goes back to what I said before, it just goes to show the impact and the power that food has. I mean, the people who talk about weight and obesity and all that make the point that we're programmed to take in extra food. The reality is our ancestors 40,000 years ago were lucky if they stumbled across a stray carcass every 2 weeks or so, and we'd top up for and try and keep ourselves going for a couple of weeks. So we're programmed to take food into us. The problem is because of the vast array of food that's available to us, it means that we put on the weight. And here's the issue, is that trying to cut sugar out of the diet is actually difficult. The only way to do it is just cut it out, simple as. You just have to cut it out and either try to convert over to having sugar and tea without milk, sorry, try again, tea and coffee without sugar, or alternatively use a sweetener.
Now, this next one is unusual, but I think it's a topic that Trasa may be coming back to on Kerry Today tomorrow. It's to do with the this invasive moth or caterpillar that is in Ireland at the moment. There's articles about it. But this listener says that her 10-month-old baby has conjunctivitis and pharyngitis, and she now has both of those conditions as well. Now, apparently there was an article in the paper linking these conditions to this particular new type of moth that has been recorded in Ireland. She's wondering if you know anything about it and could there possibly be a link to them?
Yeah, it's not something that's come up on my radar yet. In our literature, it hasn't been spoken about. The reality is that, okay, upper respiratory tract infections are not completely gone away, and I am seeing a couple of kids and indeed adults with conjunctivitis and tonsillitis, so that's not unusual. You'll always see a bit of that year round. It's less common at this time of the year than it would be in the winter and the springtime, but it certainly is around. No, I haven't seen anything come across my radar yet or anything in the literature about any connection between the moth and conjunctivitis and tonsillitis.
Yeah, I believe Trasa will be speaking about that moth and and sightings of it on radio on the Kerry Today programme tomorrow morning, just to let listeners know about that. And Eamon, I was going to finish with you, but there is a fairly serious sounding one, and I would like your thoughts on this. It's a lady in her 60s with mental health issues. She doesn't specify what. She said she hadn't been taking the meds that were prescribed for her, and she had fallen back again to having suicidal thoughts. She's in care at the moment and back taking her meds. She's wondering, how long will it take after this lapse before I get my normal life back again?
Yeah, and there's a huge difficulty there, because the first and foremost, everybody is individual, and different people react in different ways. Typically, if somebody is suffering from a depression, you're looking at probably starting off with at least a month and up to 3 months before you begin to sort of normalise the mood, but it can take longer depending on the circumstances. And some people you're looking at underlying issues that continue. You see, again the thing about it is the medication in of itself is an assistance and an aid and a use and is useful, but really you've got to look at the individual and their own particular life story. And this woman is in her 60s, she's got 6 years of life history behind her, and what are the issues that go all the way back to childhood that prompt her or bring her to the point where she has her depressive illness now? And indeed, what's the family history? The family history of depressive illness, which has a bearing on this as well. The difficulty is you cannot say in the individual, you travel in hope and the expectation that the situation will get better, but you just don't know when that's going to happen.
Yeah, this is it. Well, we can just wish her all the best. And it sounds like she's on the right track, though, Eamon. I mean, if she's in, it sounds like she might be in hospital and she's back on her meds. So, you know, the only way is up,
that's
really.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, Eamon. Well, listen, we leave you there. Sorry that we went a little bit over time, but we had lots of questions for you. And we didn't get around to all of them, but sure, there's always next week. Eamon, thanks a million, and enjoy the rest of the day.
Mind yourself, girl. Take care.
That's Dr. Eamon Shanahan there, joining us from his surgery in Farran 4 with this week's Medical Matters. Now, just before we finish up,